You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Jim Goldston, the director of the Open Society Justice Initiative, and very pleased to be hosting this panel on the impacts of strategic litigation. We have three fantastic star panelists with us today to talk about a subject that is coursing right through the Open Society Foundations and beyond. On my far right, Colin Gonsalves is perhaps India's premier human rights litigator and the founding director of the leading strategic litigation organization, Human Rights Legal Network, who has pursued and secured a number of path-breaking judgments that we will be hearing about in that country. His left is Sherilyn Eiffel, who is the president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, the premier civil rights organization in the United States, who wears many other hats. One of them is as a member of the Open Society Foundation's board. And then Dimitri Holtzman, who is currently a fellow at Columbia University, but was the executive director of the Education Equality Law Center, a leading legal center allied to the one of the premier organizations seeking equal access to quality education in South Africa, which has undertaken really some path-breaking work that I hope we'll hear about as well. So very pleased to welcome our colleagues to OSF for this discussion today. And if I can just say by way of introduction that the question of what impact, if any, strategic litigation has is of great interest to Open Society Foundations and to the Open Society Justice Initiative in particular. OSF spends a fair amount of money supporting strategic litigation around the world. And let me just say as well that we'll be talking about various terms. I'm using the term strategic litigation to talk about any litigation that is advocacy inside a courtroom before a judicial body that is part of a strategy that has a conscious purpose and that is aimed at having some impact on anyone beyond the immediate applicant in the case. But people talk about public interest litigation, of course, social action litigation, test litigation, etc. And OSF supports a lot of that. We don't quite know how much, though the ability to figure that out is improving year by year, so we'll come back to you with the final numbers when we have it. But we know it's a lot. The Justice Initiative engages in a lot of litigation with partners around the world. So we have a collective interest here at the Foundation at learning more about what works, what doesn't, and whether we're throwing our money down the tube, frankly. And that's one interest in this. To some extent, strategic litigation is a test of a country of the existence of the rule of law in its fullest manifestations in a particular country, but at the same time, it is a contribution to the construction and consolidation of the rule of law, one hopes. And we're hopefully going to hear a little bit about how that has happened in three different contexts. But I think it's fair to say, and here's where maybe we can begin with a question, that certainly among the academic literature and in large portions of NGO communities in different countries, there is a trope of critique of strategic litigation, like it was nice once, but we've kind of gone beyond that. We've learned a lot of things about how expensive litigation is, how elitist it is at practiced in certain contexts, how counterproductive it can be by creating an adversarial relationship where maybe that's not needed, how it diverts attention from other kinds of advocacy towards change, whether on the street or letter writing or in the parliament or whatever, and yet, at least if one looks anecdotally at the kinds of groups that Open Society and a few like donors are supporting, it is a phenomenon that is proliferating around the world into countries that where it never existed before. The Ford Foundation did a path-breaking study back in 2000, Many Roads to Justice. that talked about the public interest law work that its grantees were doing. And if you look at the 15 years between the time that Ford did that study and now, there are dozens of new organizations that have been born and undertaken pathbreaking litigation in common law countries, in civil law countries, north, south, east, west, everywhere it's just exploding. So if I may begin by asking colleagues, and maybe Sherilyn, let me turn to you if I can to begin. Is everybody just mistaken? Are we all getting it wrong? Are the foundations wasting their money? Are the groups who are engaging in this activity just misguided?
No, I don't think so. First of all, thank you so much for asking me to join this extraordinary gathering and for teeing up what I think are complicated and important questions to be asking about strategic litigation. You know, in many ways, I feel as though the organization I lead, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, is in some ways responsible for much of what became the attraction of this kind of litigation, certainly in the United States, but I would say it even kind of jumped the shark internationally because of the model that was used by LDF and because of the kind of seminal, what was regarded as the seminal success of Brown versus Board of Education, which essentially was the decision that began the end of legal apartheid in this country 100 years after the end of the Civil War. And the Reconstruction Amendment. So there was this model that worked and that seemed to work, and it actually did work for about 15 or 20 years, not only in on the education front, but on multiple fronts as it relates to racial justice, as it relates to gender equality, and so forth. So there became this attraction because of the success of it. I do think it has its limitations, and one of the stories of Brown and one of the stories of our work has been a reckoning with the limitations of litigation. Litigation functioning alone can be deeply problematic, and I think many people forget that Brown actually never did function alone, that there always was this interaction with people on the ground. As a matter of fact, the Brown litigation, which challenged segregated schools in this country, was something that my organization was working on for 20 years. But the filing of the cases that became Brown, the four cases that became Brown, was really pushed by activism on the ground. In Virginia, it was pushed by a 16-year-old African-American student, Barbara Johns, who led a walkout in her segregated, inferior high school in Virginia, Moton High School. She was begged by the principal, you know, the black principal, by parents, don't do this, you know, please just wait for this process. And she was so outraged by the substandard desks, by the hand-me-down books, by the ongoing conditions in her high school, that she convinced her fellow students, 300 of them, to do this walkout of their black high school. And it was then that the lawyers began really pressuring the Legal Defense Fund and saying, I know you were waiting for the perfect case, but like we have to do something. So there always was this connection between the litigation and the ground game. And I think that story's just been forgotten, and it's therefore fed into the idea that this was just about the lawyers. So the important thing is to remember there always has to be this ground game. But I do think it's important to remember the limitations of litigation. One of the things you mentioned that people skip right over is how expensive it is. And I can tell you now, leading the organization, what I can accomplish with a very strong demand letter, I want to accomplish with a very strong demand letter. What I can accomplish with a set of meetings, what I can accomplish with some policy efforts, I want to accomplish with some policy efforts, because litigation is expensive, it's long-standing, you know, you stay in cases for years and years and years as they go up and down, and it's imperfect. But there are qualities about litigation that are really important. The power of law to state what is supposed to be the rules that govern our society is hugely important. The power of law to state what reality is, you know, one of the things that happens and happened in this country and continues to happen around issues of racial injustice is that they're very often anecdotal. They're stories that we tell in our own communities. The perfect example is police violence against unarmed African Americans. This is something we've been talking about forever and ever and ever and have not been believed. And I can tell you any number of cases that you probably have never heard of in which we've been dealing with this issue. But what law does is it allows you to create that as truth. What is an allegation, what is a story, is transformed in the process of litigation and through the presentation of evidence and the acceptance by a judge into fact. And that case, what that judge writes, now becomes the story, it's actually the creation of history. And that is hugely powerful and hugely important to marginalized communities. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Sherilyn, very much. Colin, so does that power to transform allegation into fact, has that had real resonance in India? Is the experience of public interest litigation in India one that is inspiring for folks there?
Yes, I'd agree with Cheryl largely on that. It's just that in the developing countries, you can't get ahead with writing a demand letter. Nobody listens to you. They throw it into the dustbin. You don't get much headway by even following Mahatma Gandhi's nonviolent principle and doing a hunger fast. The politicians will let you die on the streets. So you need to think of two things. Either you do direct action in very, very vigorous, not so legal or outside the law direct action, where you take the law into your own hands, which I think has its own virtues. But I don't want to talk too much about that here. And it's a feasible kind of option. And the next is to go to court in what is called a public interest litigation case. It's very cheap, so the expense angle doesn't work so much. You can get in. The filing charges are like maybe $25 to get into a court in a very big case. It's very cheap. It could be very quick. It could be very, very quick in the sense that you could file a case on Friday and get it heard on a Monday by mentioning to the judge that these cases are of importance. Like when we had a racist attack on Christians by a particular community and hundreds of them were killed in their houses burnt. The case was filed on Friday, mentioned before the Chief Justice's court, and heard on a Monday. And by Tuesday, he had passed orders for the paramilitary forces to go to that particular state because the police were acting in collusion with the rioters, massacring people and so on. So it can be very quick. Now, public interest litigation has always had its detractors. Government, of course, is our biggest enemy, and I think we take it more as a medal than a criticism when government turns very, very hostile to individuals and groups doing public interest litigation. And as long as that hostility is expressed, I think that is the best expression of the worth of public interest litigation. Some of the NGOs are not so happy with public interest litigation for reasons that may not be unjustified. So in the sense they may have valid reasons for not doing public interest litigation, perhaps some experiences that they may have had with a particular lawyer, a particular case, a particular judge who's, you know, I've seen people saying we took that case on, you know, contraceptives years ago, Depo Provera. We took that case and the judge said this and the judge said that, and I'm amazed by how many women in the movement have been turned off litigation because of that one experience that they've had, right? Now, can you assess public interest litigation and the impact of public interest litigation? I think it's easier to assess than other areas of work. Have you done a good case? Have you won the case? I take a very hard-line view on this because it's possible to do a good case and lose it, and that there's worth in, you know, even doing a case and even if you lose a case. But I say if you take a more mean kind of approach to assessment, right? Have you won the case? Have you got a judgment? Can we read the judgment? And if you won the judgment, has it been implemented? Who says it's been implemented? Have the beneficiaries come forward and said yes? And public interest litigation in India, even if you take a very mean, restrictive standard, oh my God, there are hundreds and hundreds of cases, hundreds of judgments. Translation into practice, even if you say 50% implementation is a good rate, you have hundreds and hundreds of cases. And I just want to mention three very quickly and I'll stop. Recent cases, the corruption cases. Nobody ever thought you could stop corruption in this country or even take a meaningful step. And then you had a very energetic public interest litigator through an organization called Common Cause. Take the first case regarding telecom licenses. The Congress government took money and gave multinationals and Indian companies licenses to rule the telecom waves here. Case done, Supreme Court intervened, very combative arguments, lots of papers coming, documents coming before the court, all the telecom licenses in the country cancelled. Incredible. Start from scratch, and the auction system will be the way to give government contracts. Followed by the coal licenses, where all the mining companies, including multinational companies, paid money to the government, got the contract. All set aside, every one of them, and auctions introduced. And then the appointment of the Central Vigilance Commissioner, who's the central, the main person to a constitutional post, actually, the main person who looks at corruption in the country. Again, a public interest game. You're appointing a person who himself has a case against him in one court, a forgotten case. Long back, some case against him was pending for corruption. Set aside, appointment set aside. So these kind of actions never before done, even in a country like India, where public interest litigation is so common. And if you ask impact, huge impact. Systemic change, huge systemic change. And the way in which the country is governed, has it really impacted the way in which India is governed? I would say yes.
Dimitri, in South Africa, there was, of course, litigation challenging various aspects of the apartheid regime during its existence, but clearly litigation was not the chief vehicle by which apartheid was brought down, right? There was massive popular protest in the streets, reinforced to some extent by international pressure and other tools. Since the advent of democratic government, how important a role do you see litigation playing in South Africa in fulfilling the promises, the great promises of one of the great constitutions in the world?
Sure. And also just to say thanks also for having me here. I just want to pick up before answering that specifically on two things that I've heard. One which I entirely agree with is that the issue of understanding what the limitations of litigation are, I think, is important when we're looking at this question about the impact. You know, my immediate answer to say, in asking is there a point, does it actually have effect, is yes. But then the lawyer part of me comes in and says, but it also depends. You know, the effect and impact depends on a number of factors. One of which I think is also, you know, Colin, we were speaking about developing countries and the options that you then have, either being direct action or litigation. I would say that, in fact, the way in which we've understood our role is to try and combine both, and that the relative ability to generate impact is then most effective when we are actually able to combine direct action and strategic litigation, and specifically with strategic litigation, and I'll give a couple of examples if you allow, can support direct action rather than being seen as just an additional tool, but in fact where the question of, for example, how it is that you can make sure that a judgment that does in fact get passed has the highest prospects of being implemented to the greatest extent possible is then usually dependent on the ability of direct action to be able to follow on that. And something that we've tried to do is craft the litigation that we look at as not being a kind of final point, but rather a way in which can support then further political action and development. But secondly, I think the question of the specific legal context, the appetite of the judiciary, for example, to be willing to hear these cases. If we're looking, for example, at the limitations of litigation, I'd say that where the criticism on the limited impact that it has holds most true is actually around issues around socioeconomic rights litigation. So it's easier, it's easier to deal with corruption cases, for example, where you can see an impact much more quickly than if we're talking about implementing a education policy that's going to change, in some instances, hundreds of years of backlogs. And it's in those areas where I think lawyers need to be circumspect in terms of what it is that we can actually achieve, and there where the issue of direct action combined with strategic litigation becomes most important. Post-1994 in South Africa, I think there are many examples, in fact, that we can use. Although looking at 20 years of democracy, 20 years of having a very comprehensive Bill of Rights, some people would argue that the amount of litigation that's been brought has actually not been as high as what would have been expected. We're starting to see an increase and a change in that in the last couple of years, which I think is both positive, but in some instances, I know Colin might take issue with me on this, but might be sometimes dangerous in creating too much of a reliance on the judiciary, putting too much pressure and on judges who are not often equipped enough to, for example, where they are in some limited instances issuing structural interdicts. Our courts are very wary about doing that. Because, for example, how much time should the court be able to allocate or resources allocate in monitoring, changing the face of school infrastructure, for example? Do they have the ability to do that? And yet we are seeing an increased amount of litigation that's seeking those kinds of orders. So while I think, and maybe in your follow-up questions you'll ask us to give some examples, I'd be able to refer to those. I think that there is definitely an increasing role for lawyers to play, but that a lot of that is actually dependent on the broader political context. And in fact, I would say the role of lawyers needs to be changing and understanding ourselves as how is it that we're not just waiting for that case to come so that we can go to court. How do we actively write letters of demand, provide ongoing legal support, take on strategic litigation here and there, but ultimately be looking to build people's power, build movements, and use the law in a way that does that, which I think is much more effective than looking at the question of strategic litigation in isolation. Without saying too much more, I think I'll stop there on that.
Thank you, Dimitri. Sherilyn, is the role of lawyers changing? Derek Bell was one of just a number of people who wrote a very powerful critique of the relationship of lawyers to various civil rights movements in the 1950s and 60s, and suggested, if I recall, that there was a sense that lawyers, to some extent, did not necessarily represent their clients' interests in shaping the litigation in certain ways, at least in some cases. Have lawyers learned from that experience, and today do lawyers conduct themselves with that experience in mind, and if so, how does that influence the strategic nature of the litigation?
Well, I'd say two things. First of all, I'm actually giving the Derek Bell lecture this year, and he was a great mentor of mine, and his criticisms of the kind of litigation that he was engaged in at LDF, I think was really important to be heard and said, particularly when you're engaged in litigation that takes place over a long period of time. So you begin, a case in 1950. And then in 1967, right, you're still working on that case. It's a whole different set of parents. It's a different set of kids. The zeitgeist of the country has changed. It's the difference between the circumspection of the 1950s and the Black Power movement of the 1960s, right? And the lawyers remain static while the community is changing and dynamic. So I think that, or the community, started out with you, but now they're saying, you know what? It's not worth it to me to place my children in harm's way if the resistance from white people is going to be so violent. I'm not interested in integration. I'm interested in my rights. So that idea of your clients being part of the team is something that certainly I've very much integrated. The idea that you are always constantly in communication with your clients and they are helping shape the outcome of the case. So I think that has been actually felt by lawyers and certainly affects the way I practice and the way I lead LDF. But I also think that this idea of understanding what the community needs as first and foremost is something that's transformed civil rights litigation and really public law litigation, in the U.S. across the board. The idea of the client as the center and not you as the center is really important. Now, this is an ongoing message that has to be reinforced because lawyers do play to their strengths. We do it. You learn how to do something, and then everything looks like that thing that you know how to do. So it requires serious discipline and vigilance to be able to do it. And I'll give you an example. Many of you saw the video of Walter Scott, the man who was killed by police officers in North Charleston, the man who was running in the park and was shot and was seen all over the world. And we've been down in North Charleston talking and working with that community. And we already had a relationship with the community because we've done voting rights litigation there for a long time. So this is not a new relationship, but it's an ongoing relationship with the community that we've worked with over many years. And what the community told us was that, while there is this prosecution of the officer who shot Walter Scott that is ongoing, and that's obviously not something we're involved in, that's the state prosecutors prosecuting the police officer, Michael Slager, they wanted us to understand the context of policing in that community and to understand that this was not a one-off. So we We spent a lot of time just talking with people about what was happening in that community. They asked us on their behalf to write a letter to the Attorney General of the United States asking her to launch a pattern and practice investigation of the police in North Charleston. And they provided us examples of their of many experiences that they have had, violent experiences with police in that community. And so we did that. We crafted a very long, detailed letter to the Attorney General, and we've continued in our relationships in Washington, D.C. to press that pattern and practice. We've heard nothing from the Attorney General, and we suspect that we won't hear anything anytime soon. So we talked with the community, and what they decided they wanted was to continue to press ahead with their own investigation. And what they wanted was to have a people's town hall in which they provided this information publicly, and they wanted us to help them do it. And so we did. We got a court reporter to come in to be able to transcribe the stories of individuals about their encounters with police. We got the location, we made it all happen. Our organizers went out and did the flyers and helped people in the community come. And that's what they wanted. They want to begin the process, whether or not the law is going to recognize the pattern and practice investigation or not. They want to begin as though they are creating their own pattern and practice. So that's something that we're helping them do. It's not litigation. It's not a case. We are continuing to ask the Attorney General to press the pattern and practice, but we're also trying to support this community in their effort to take the matter into their own hands, to, through their own power, challenge the nature of policing in that community. So there are these ways in which I think, you know, putting the clients at the center and hearing from them what they really want allows you to counsel them, which is to say, here are the ways in which I think the law, the formal legal system can help you. Here are the other things that can be done that can help you that we can provide support for. Here are the things that you can do that really we can't really help you with, but you may find these things effective. And that's really our job as lawyers, is to be able to counsel the community about the array of choices that are available to them, to help and support them with those that fall into our expertise, to broker for them relationships with others who can provide them the support that we need. But that's the kind of example, I think, of being able to be flexible and creative in your space as a lawyer, where you're doing more than one thing for the community, but at the center of it is helping them express how they want to speak truth to power.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Colin, I know you've thought a lot and your whole professional career is very much about the relationship of public interest lawyers to broader communities, and you brought some seminal cases on behalf of communities. I wonder if you could make a couple of observations about that, and particularly the comment that Dimitri made, that there are different kinds of public interest, and in assessing impacts, you've got to talk about the different kinds of litigation you're talking about, and maybe when you're dealing with social and economic rights, if I understood Dimitri correctly, impact may be harder to assess and or harder to secure. What's the experience in India?
Let me just say a few words about the role of the public interest lawyer first.
Please.
I have a very sort of sharp take on the role of the lawyer. And I start with Ambedkar's observations. He was the chairperson of the committee that drafted the Indian Constitution. Loved by the people of India, but particularly loved by the Dalit community, which are the low caste. Roughly put, you could say the Indian equivalent of Martin Luther King in terms of, you know, the fiery nature of his personality and his ability to combine constitutionalism with movement. And he would say, to get rid of oppression, you must organize, educate, and agitate. And I would add one word to that, and that is instigate.
I thought you were
going to
say litigate.
No. You see, I was a trade unionist before I became a lawyer. And I was very inspired by a person called Datta Samant, who was a very militant trade unionist in Bombay. At that time, when I was the organizing secretary, we had 1 million workers in our union. And if there's anything Datta Samant taught us, it was to break the law, not to go by the law. Because the courts were very repressive institutions and the law was used to confine agitation and struggle, even non-violent struggle, just assembly was a crime. And he taught us that, and I learned the lesson. When I looked through the eyes of working class people, I learned the lesson that the working class people must, in their attempt to get emancipation, they must learn when and where to actually take the law into their own hands and disregard the law. Now, it might sound very heretical to say this, but let me give you a simple example. Tribal people live on lands. Indigenous people live on lands everywhere in the world. They don't have title to land like an Englishman has, right? He's living on government land for, like, decades, his grandfather and his grandfathers before them. But English law will tell you, or, you know, law will tell you right across the world that you're a trespasser. And the state will tell you, I can come and take your land whenever I want for a public project because you're an encroacher on land. What do Adivasis do? Do they write letters? No. Do they go to the courts? No, the court will say, what right do you have, sir? You've stayed for, you know, 1,000 years, so what? This is government land. Get off the land. So what do? They organize, they resist the local police, and the government will send in the paramilitary forces, they'll fight them tooth and nail, making homemade bombs and pistols and so on, and then they'll send in the army and they'll resist them tooth and nail. And they'll say, we won't give our land, we won't give our forests, we won't give our waters, we will resist. Right. Perfectly correct. And then they ask us as human rights lawyers, what do you say, Mr. Gonsalves? They're breaking the law. And I say, correctly so. Your law is wrong, your law is bad, your law is antiquated, your law is obsolete. This land is their land. And contemporary customary law of indigenous people, if you look at the case law from South America, or you look at the case law from Australia, will say, yes, they have a right to claim their rights, as you know, their rights over land. And they're not going to move, sir. And if they're breaking the law, so be it. And I say it on TV debates, if they're breaking the law, so be it. You change the law. Gandhi broke the law, right, when he had that Dandi march, that there was a British law which said you can't make salt. So he said, come on, let's break the law. And didn't Gandhi break the law 100 times in making movements against government orders? He was prosecuted 100 times. And he stood before the court and said, your job is to implement the law, sir. He told the judges, your job is to implement your law. And I don't hold it against you. I respect you for that. My law is to lead my people to emancipation and freedom. And that is what I do, irrespective of your law. So we must know what the law is. We must know when to take the law, you know, at face value, when to break the law, when it's necessary. What is the role of the lawyer? What is the role of the lawyer? The role of the lawyer is to be a great instigator of people's movements. In a situation where the blood is just below boiling point, it's there, you can sense the anger. They don't know, is it right to do, is it wrong to do, they're breaking the law. When it's at that point, the role of the lawyer, with all his understanding or her understanding of law and social movements and everything, the role of the lawyer is to bring that blood to boil. That's your role. And then to defend in the courts and to defend outside the court, there must be a seamless movement. A seamless movement between struggle, agitation and the courts. You must be able to get into the courts, get out of the courts, get into the courts, get out of the courts. Like lawyers did during the freedom movement against the British. They were in, they were out, they were in jail half the time. Many of our lawyers are in jail. Many of our lawyers have been killed. So in a developing country, your understanding of law, the use of law, the role of the lawyer, public interest litigation is a tiny part of that. An important but tiny part. Right? The social movement, change, and the very important role of the lawyer that gives people courage. They know that what's right and what's wrong. They know what's right and what's wrong. But when you tell them as a lawyer that it's okay to do it, the consequences will be this. We can't save you. This is the consequences. But it's right in equity and morality and law to do something. That is the role of the lawyer, the instigator of social movements. Sorry about that, Jeff.
Fantastic. We did not teach that in most of my law schools. So, do you, just before going on, would you care to reflect just briefly on the purported fundamental difference of socioeconomic rights and the ability of litigation to affect that sphere?
Yeah, I think on social. I'm sorry, Jim.
I missed your question. No, that's great. that was wonderful.
That was very.
I just want to give you that opportunity. Yeah.
See, on social economic rights, Jim, the impact is huge. The right to food case, you know, I don't want to talk about that much. It's well documented, but the right to food case, where starvation deaths in our country 10 years ago was eliminated by litigation, assisted by social movement, is huge. The other kind of cases that are being done on health rights, on housing rights, and so on, it's very possible that socio-economic litigation can have huge impacts. Where there has been sustained exploitation for a long period of time. So I do believe that socio-economic litigation in the courts has huge. Education, I believe, where India has a law and it's not implemented, education will see, through public interest litigation, huge systemic change. You will see systemic change in areas in developing countries which have remained very backward for long periods of time. You don't know why. I don't know, I always felt in South Africa education was an area, food was an area. I also felt in South Africa there were areas where things were so bad for so long, public interest litigation could possibly change that. But in India, definitely, and in many countries of Asia, economic rights will go through big changes.
Dimitri, so that's a great segue for you to respond, reflect. The general question, I guess, is since we're three different systems are reflected here, three different traditions of public interest strategic litigation. So are we bringing these together just because it's an interesting discussion, or is there actual practical relevance to the learning across borders? Does it matter what happens in the United States or India or anywhere else when it comes to South African social actors, litigators, others thinking, what should we do and how should we do it? Or are you deriving it from your historical experience primarily, which makes perfect sense?
Sure. Yes, it depends on where you're at. I think Colin would say, I don't care what anyone else is doing. I'm going to go ahead and do this in any case. I want to just respond to something that Colin was saying. I agree with much of what you're saying, except you've just mentioned also that you're a lawyer from a trade unionist background. And I see some of that possibly influencing where your approach is. Because the extent to which I agree is that there is a role for lawyers to instigate. I think there is a role, most definitely, for lawyers to be there to defend social movements or people that are standing up for their power and that are face resistance or repression in some instances, and where the law may be used as a tool. And some instances it may not even. It may not be not be available. But I am cautious about the idea that the lawyer must be the instigator in all circumstances. In our context in South Africa, we've got a few instigator lawyers, but the point from which they're instigating is not always from a perspective of what is best for the community. It's what is best for the lawyer, what is best for the jurisprudence, for example. We've got an example in education. I won't mention the name, but there's a particular advocate who is kind of gung-ho on all types of government accountability cases with his own agenda, and which is not always attached in any way to particular clients or to movements. In fact, he's a rogue lawyer who is looking to, in any which way, show up the government and, in essence, develop the law in that. Now, there may be certain advantages in that, but some of the disadvantages we've seen, for example. So let me give you the particular case. This advocate's been sitting with a draft notice of motion around education, a case for education, basically calling out any client which can come in for full, which in essence can allow me to sign the paper, but I've set out the case before I've even spoken to anybody. And we have been very concerned about that kind of lawyering, where it is literally instigating a case, not necessarily a movement, which could be very dangerous for not only the amount of work that has been built up towards litigating and developing the law around education up until now, but also could set back possible, through one really bad judgment, could set us back many, many years down the line. And so that's why I think it goes back to this issue of where the lawyer is able to situate themselves in the community, so that there isn't this idea that the lawyer is only the savior. But in fact, where we've got lawyers, and this is sometimes very difficult, in fact, for lawyers to do, is to be embedded with organizing, with communities, so that there is a kind of shared understanding, there is a partnership, and there's not a dictatorial relationship between lawyers and the clients. And sometimes that can be very, very difficult to achieve. It also then depends on the way in which society itself is organizing. The lawyers can, as you say, come with the best intentions, but sometimes be completely off track with what the needs are, and not only where certain rights can be won in court, but where's the overlap between that and actually being able to generate real change for real clients, in fact. So that's just the one thing, is that I think it depends again on the context and the ability for lawyers as social movement lawyers to organize themselves in the way that I think develops that proper perspective. In terms of the question of you know, whether or not we look elsewhere, I mean, I think that that's definitely it. In some instances, we are fortunate to not have to make certain arguments around the justiciability of certain rights, for example. You know, South Africa coming late to the game in developing its constitution and democracy has had the advantage, in fact, of drawing on international experiences from, you know...
And mistakes.
I was coming here. both the advantages of and the mistakes. You know, and I think, again, in education, being in the States now, for example, it's fascinating for me to see how many legal organizations there are that are focusing solely on education work, how much litigation has actually happened around that, and yet how
much unsuccessful litigation.
Precisely. Which has been, if anything, it's just been a warning about how it is that we take on these cases. And, you know, I mentioned the issue of the judiciary's appetite to hear these kinds of cases, which I think, again, is also very important. And that's where this overlap between developing social movements that can generate a public discourse, that can get the media on board with getting the right kinds of facts available to people so that they understand what the actual issues are, and in essence create a political climate that then makes a case more ripe for when it is brought to court, rather than, you know, rushing off to that as a start, can be very important. But then also just in terms of the issues that you take on. You know, if you look at education as an example in a field, one of the things that we, few law organizations that are dealing with education cases in South Africa have been very careful about both the timing, I think, but also the kinds of cases that we've started to prepare the judiciary for engaging with broadening what the idea what the nature and content of the right to education actually is. And we looked to the United States to see where have you been able to get successful victories or successful court orders that have led to actual change. You know, where do we start, for example, looking at access to education issues before going into the bigger and more important, arguably, question around quality of education? I'm already starting to see some of those cases come through the United States after, you know, 50-plus years of litigation. I think it's a mixture, though, because, again, we cannot compare the socio-political circumstances of any particular country, what the judiciary looks like, what the respect of rule of law is, what the level of social organizing and mobilization has been, are just one of the few factors that need to be considered in us developing our own strategies back home. And so, yes, I mean, I think it would be remiss for us not to look at international experience and allow that to inform us, but not to necessarily follow and say we can then take that strategy that's been used in the United States or that's failed there, that will definitely fail here. That's not always the case. I think you have to have an understanding of what your particulars and your context actually mean for your strategy.
Great. Thank you very much. I want to turn to one other issue before opening it up for colleagues to participate here. But since we're in a foundation, I do need to ask a little bit about the political economy of this phenomenon. It is, since we don't know down to the last cent how much is spent on strategic litigation around the world, but we do know that a small number of private foundations support a large proportion of the litigation that's undertaken. Does that matter? Does that matter for the cause? Does that matter for the legitimacy? Does that matter for the success of the arguments? Does that matter for the manner in which the judgments that depend on that support are received and how effectively they're implemented? Are those issues any of you need to deal with in your work?
Well, I would say that one advantage that I have regarded as very important to our work, because very often we're facing either lawyers of the state or private lawyers, particularly when we're in the economic area where we're bringing cases around employment discrimination or environmental justice and so forth, and we're facing private lawyers who are very well resourced, is the sense that we will be able to stick with this. And sometimes I'm not sure we can, but I can say it credibly that if I have started a case, you know, it may take 7 years. But we can stick with it, and we can stick with it at the same level that you're bringing to the table. That's actually a very powerful and important thing particularly around litigation that's focused on race in the U.S., to be able to say and to be able to demonstrate to our opponents, because it very often is, the way litigation is here, a war of attrition. We don't end up in the Supreme Court shortly. We don't, you know, file on Friday and end up there on Monday. It is a war of attrition, and resources are used as part of the tool of our opponents essentially wage their war with, that they know that they can wear us down. So knowing that we have the resources to be able to manage that litigation going forward is really vitally important. It's also true that having your independence is important. So we don't take any money from any government. And that's an article of faith that's really important, because we sue governments all the time, and we want to be able to do that without ever seeking government funds. And it's important for the communities that we work in to know that too, to know that we're not so hard up that we can be bought in any way by any governmental source. The other thing I would say is I actually value the fact that we make attorney's fees when we prevail. I think it's really actually important. We are at this point probably, we've done at least for the last 3 years about $1 million in attorney's fees from winning cases in New York City and other places around, you know, police abuse, around employment discrimination, and so forth.
This is just to clarify, this is attorney's fees under federal statutes that provide fees vindicating certain claims.
And those provisions in federal statutes were hard fought for and important precisely because they would give the power and the authority to organizations like mine and others to be able to generate their own fees, which I think is vitally important as well. Let me just say a last thing about the kind of litigation that we think of as public interest litigation here. You know, when civil rights and environmental statutes were being enacted and passed in the 1960s and 70s, the idea of those statutes was that we wanted to give private individuals or organizations the ability to function like what we call private attorneys generals, that you could actually have a public role and you would be bringing litigation on behalf of the public. And so to be able to do that, I think, is really an important and powerful tool. It's actually been forgotten very much in, certainly in civil rights litigation. We're not treated very often by judges as though we are providing this service to the public, which I'm constantly reminding them of. Like when we vindicate, you know, the civil rights of people to participate and vote in an election, we're doing it on behalf of this community, but we're actually doing it on behalf of the public as well. So I think that role is really important to maintain and to preserve, and that's actually the way in which I think the foundation support kind of speaks to the values of the foundation, because the litigation is not really on behalf of individuals, although it may be on behalf of individuals. It really is part of the public apparatus and the public service of vindicating the rights of people who are most marginalized, who have the least power, and so forth. And as I say, it's kind of free stuff for everybody else. The reason why people criticize public law litigation in this country is because the effects of it have become ubiquitous. And I say this all the time. I'm always in these, you know, fancy rooms where people say, tell me, you know, was Brown a success, or whatever is the question. And I'm always in a room full of people that would not be in that room but for this litigation, that wouldn't have been hired at the places that they were hired but for the years of this litigation. It's almost become like air. And I think this is something to just watch out for and think about in the future, that the success of your work can become so deeply embedded that it's no longer understood as being connected to the work of communities that sacrificed and lawyers that litigated and so forth. It becomes just kind of, I'm sure that America was headed in this direction anyway. America was not headed in this direction at all. In fact, America marshaled all its resources not to head in this direction. But we forget that. And so we say, I wonder if it had an effect. Kind of, yeah, it did. And I think it's important for us to remind people of that. When we do these calculations, especially with foundations of, you know, you have to prove and evaluate your work and prove the success of your work, there is no metric for the free stuff that we've given. For every business person who is American who gets to go around the world and talk as though they are from a country that is somehow superior to other countries, we gave them that. And we gave them that because we pressed and created a country in which, at least in the law, you could not have this apartheid system, which was a shame for the country, right? And so everyone benefited from it in all kinds of ways that are just not quantified. And so I just think it's important for foundations in thinking about supporting this work all over the world to think about the fact that it's not just about whether you won the case. It actually is about the way you transformed a level of thinking about the human condition in particular societies and in particular countries that's almost never traced back and attributed to the people who really worked and fought and sacrificed and made that happen.
Thank you for providing an important justification for the work of many people in this room. That's being duly noted here. But let me ask, Colin, Dimitri, if you wish, the situation of the fact that so much of the funding for public interest litigation comes from often American foundations, is that not a tricky issue in some of the cases or places you operate, or no?
For India, little comes from America.
Okay.
Little comes. The big supporter for work in India is the German NGOs. The Scandinavian countries have left. There is actually, and I can't understand it, there's very little funding for public interest litigation or strategic litigation. Very little.
So most of the support for the litigation comes from people giving their time, from paying clients, from where?
No, it just, whatever comes in, you spread it out very thinly. So the senior most lawyer that would work 12 hours a day, every day of the week, Saturday, Sunday, would get a salary of $1,000 a month. So you just get what comes in and you spread it out. So there's very little support, actually, despite the fact that the impact of public interest litigation is there to see for everyone. So I don't know. I think it's just that supporters have lost the appetite for struggle. Because even economic rights litigation is very struggle-oriented. Take land and displacement from land. How do you make a distinction between economic rights and political? There's no distinction at all. Adivasis fighting to retain their lands immediately get into struggle against the state. There's very little appetite. I think there's a rapidly decreasing appetite for struggle. And there's a rapidly decreasing appetite to support organizations that are combative in their work. So they are productive, they get results, they do good work, they work very cheaply, they don't have health insurance, they don't have an office, they work very well, but combativeness is something that turns up. So we get some support from America, which has stayed with us. We get some support from Germany. Germany is very pro-struggle. They understand, for some reason, I can't understand it. All the other countries of Europe have abandoned us, but Germany is very much in that. Are you doing struggling against the sale? We give you money for that. And it's like core funding, so they don't, it's not like, you know, at the end of 3 years, you know, apply again and maybe we give you, or can you switch to something else? But I'd say we are struggling actually on the basic support.
Yeah, I'll just deal with the one narrow part of your question about the effect of, which is again a different situation to India and South Africa, having, you know, 5 or 6 major foundations which are providing support for public interest litigation and other civil society organizing work, is that firstly there's a challenge in South Africa is that the most of the funding comes from those few organizations, and that we as a society have not been able to generate alternative sources of funding, which has created a massive dependence on those few organizations. What I think is a natural implication of that is that it does then start to create a certain level of unhealthy competition amongst organizations, which are then constantly scrambling for resources from the same small pool. It's a very unfortunate consequence, because ultimately, you know, we're all fighting the same enemy, which are the conditions rather than, may not be understood to be saying the state is necessarily the enemy, but there's the unhealthy competition that comes from that. But I think one thing that perhaps is an easier way for foundations to lessen the way in which that competition is created, but also the way in which funding is provided, so that it further supports what I see as a division or dichotomy between public interest law work and social mobilization. If there, you were speaking about the metrics, for example, in how is it that a law organization can show its impact, or if its programs, if it's set out to meet these objectives. Most of the ways in which that happens, one of the things would be how many times have you taken on a case, or has your case been successful? And we've, for some foundations, then got to show that these were how many clients that were then affected by any particular litigation. When in fact, in many instances, the benefits of strategic litigation can be much wider, and are usually much wider than the narrow implementation or otherwise of a particular court order. And so I think that, if foundations are going to be more responsible and would actually assist in law organizations becoming more infused with movements, in providing support which sees the, in fact, what Colin speaks about, the streamless line between organizing and the courts. I can't remember what the middle one was, but that streamless line is something that can't see litigation as lawyers sitting waiting there for a case to come and then suddenly now we jump into action. If you're going to build, even as a strategy for building effective public interest litigation, the support that you have to be giving is ongoing from the beginning. And in fact, for us, the approach that we've taken is that if we don't get to court, in fact, that's the victory. We've then, most of the times, won the battle because we've been able to provide legal support that then generates political pressure that can have change from before we even get into this long process of getting stuck in court. To touch on something that Sherilyn was saying, we've had a similar situation where government, which is usually the respondent in all of these socioeconomic cases, has simply adopted a strategy to say, okay, bring whatever case you want and we'll defend it, even with sometimes the most ridiculous time-wasting arguments. And their strategy is to say, we will actually make sure you run out of, firstly, that the momentum that you've built up outside of court is going to run out of steam, because the moment you get involved in your first letter of demand and response, we can now delay this, in fact, up until a year. And watch how the delaying tactics correlate with the election cycles, for example. I mean, we've had instances where you can watch and say, the government is waiting for us to come to court on this issue. Because then you go to court and we're stuck in pre-trial proceedings for a long, they've got 8 months to go until the next election, and we'll deal with this issue after the next election, because, that becomes a strategy. Only to then, at the last minute, and we've had this on some of our biggest cases, 2 days before trial, we've been preparing for 9 months to get to court, and 2 days before trial, the government will come and say, okay, let's settle this. Which has been a massive waste of our resources, and is becoming a government strategy which understands the litigation aspect as being a final straw, which in many instances it should be, but the legal work to get you to that point must have started, in fact, in many instances years before that. And I think that is a way in which foundations can understand that providing funding, whether it be core funding or for programs that doesn't require lawyers to have to prove their worth by how many times they've been in court, but understanding that there are other ways in which they can provide ongoing support, and which is sometimes less tangible, but just as critical in developing a practice of movement lawyering that sees lawyers as part of a bigger movement rather than the end of it.
Can I just add one thing to that? Because we just got funding for a project like that's kind of responsive to what you're talking about. When I came aboard to lead LDF, I felt very powerfully that this was the most important thing I could do, was to get support for this institute within LDF that would allow us to hire more organizers. We had two organizers on staff, but we're only limited to criminal justice, and I felt we need organizers for all of our work. So it allowed us to add more organizers, allowed us to increase strategic communications, allowed us to bring on people to do research so we could do our own research, which has been really helpful in this whole policing context now, where we really need to understand what is happening in particular communities, and allow us to really launch affirmative campaigns that may have a litigation piece and may not have a litigation piece. And I think that when you talked about the transformation of public law litigation, I think that it's recognizing those components. The losses that we faced in civil rights in the United States were somewhat to do with the transformation from the Supreme Court, from the Warren Court, but also had to do with our failure to steward the other parts of the movement that are essential to help understand how language plays this important role, to understand, you know, what the role of media and communications would be. We didn't predict the advent of the 24-hour news cycle. We didn't see how the right was going to use our own language and transform it into language for themselves. We didn't see any of that, and even when we began to see it, we didn't respond to it in kind. So I think, and that's part of what you have to be able to provide to the clients that you represent and to the community, the ability to sustain their narrative and their story. I taught law for 20 years, and I used to tell my students that your job, you know, as the lawyer, is not that you yourself are trying to create an opportunity for you to speak. If you're doing the job really well, you have created the platform and the opportunity for your client to speak and to be able to tell their story. And for your client to speak and tell their story in modern civil rights litigation in the U.S. requires that you also play some role in creating the context in which the judges are hearing this case, that you are enabling them to affect the public conversation about race, the public conversation about policing, the public conversation about education. So I just think thinking through the future of that litigation and then how you would evaluate the success has to look at those other elements that are non-litigation elements but that are supportive of the overall movement that may include litigation.
Excellent.
Can I say one more short thing?
You may.
I also think we need more lawyers like Colin that come from trade union backgrounds to become lawyers.
There are no other lawyers like
Colin. That's true.
The clone Colin.
But, you know, that you were saying that's not something that they teach us in law school, you know? I mean, I myself have also, when I left law school, I didn't want to become a lawyer anymore. I wanted to, you know, be involved with activists, and that's what I did. Until at some point I realized, okay, well, now we actually do need a couple more lawyers that will, you know, be working hand in hand with us. But I think that's also something that is currently lacking, is that lawyers have the experience of going to law school, going into only a law organization where they don't always have the kind of experience of working in a bigger movement, you know, and understanding that there is perhaps a space for us as lawyers not to be seen as something that's set apart from, but can start to think ourselves as together with people that are working in activist organizations.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So, colleagues, anyone here? There's been a lot put on the table, a lot to take issue with, a lot to praise, a lot to question. Excellent. Thank you for your bravery.
Hi. Thank you for a great discussion. My name is Tamar Ezer, and I work here at the Public Health Program, and I lead our law and health work. So this discussion is very relevant for the work we're doing on health rights litigation. The question I have is actually for Sherilyn, and I was interested in, you know, U.S. context, and version of what you asked Jim to Dimitri about lessons from the international community. And are there any lessons from the international community that we're taking and are informing the work now in the U.S. context? And also, what do you see as opportunities for litigation on social and economic rights here in the U.S.?
Well, on the first question, I would say I think we are very often, we get depressed because, you know, we actually think that public interest law litigation is so much more dynamic in places outside the U.S. than it is in the U.S. these days. Mm-hmm. And it helps us recognize how cramped, you know, our Constitution really is, as if we didn't already know, but also how lacking in imagination we have been about a whole variety of issues. I just participated last year in an effort in Detroit around water, and you probably remember this, that in Detroit last year, the city of Detroit was first of all in bankruptcy. And at the same time, the city water bureau decided to turn off water for people who were delinquent in paying their bills. And they were turning off water for 70,000 residents, almost entirely African American. The framing of this was basically as though it were a consumer matter. You know, it was people who hadn't paid their bills. And I decided that we were going to enter this field in part because I thought the brand of my organization entering it would make it a civil rights issue, even if it really wasn't seen as a civil rights issue. And it was effective. And now it was hard because it was in bankruptcy court, and that was kind of weird. But as it turns out, without us kind of trying to intervene in that forum, there really was no place to vindicate this right. And it can't be possible that nearly 100,000 people can have no water and there's no, like, forum where you can challenge that. But in fact, that was true. That's what kind of the law provided. So it really required us to do some kind of interesting things with the local ACLU, and it involved having special rapporteurs from the UN come in, and we took them around to meet all of our clients, and we had a water fair, and so they could learn and write their own report, which was then given to the bankruptcy judge. Now, although the bankruptcy judge declared that he did not have jurisdiction to hear any of these water issues, and technically speaking, he didn't, but like you, I felt like, well, somebody's got to hear it, so I mean, if we're here.
Yeah.
He was moved by the embarrassment. I mean, and that's what he called it. He said, this is an embarrassment, and he ordered, at least for the summer, a moratorium on the turnoffs because he thought it was embarrassing the city. I mean, here he was about to wrap up the bankruptcy process, and now there was this international story about people with no water in Detroit. So I think that we feel that we should be bolder, actually, in thinking about the kind of litigation that we do. I think that we were trapped by early success and then didn't pivot to imagine a different way of litigating. I mean, one thing I will say about judges, especially in the federal system, I mean, you have to surprise them. You really do, because they are from a very narrow background. Most of the federal judges in the United States are former prosecutors. They have gone to probably the same 7 or 8 law schools, if that many. Right now, the United States Supreme Court, I think all of the justices are from 2 law schools. 2 law schools, 2 religions, I don't know. I mean, so we're talking about an extremely homogeneous population of decision makers who really don't know a lot. And so part of what I think we're now seeing again is the need to play this educative function, which is the other function of litigation. And that's when you have to get creative. You know, I always remember Thurgood Marshall, people thought it was rude of him to say this, but when he went to the Supreme Court, he said about his colleagues, who, you know, he got along with more or less, he said, not one of them knew anything about Negroes, that was the word he then used, Negroes, not a single one of them, before I came on this court. They didn't know anything about Black people. And it was true, nobody said, like, he's lying. They really didn't. I mean, it was true, right? But I think that largely, you know, it's somewhat about race, but it's really about a homogeneity of experience. And even as lawyers, I mean, you talk about a lawyer with a trade union background, you know, you don't have federal judges who have had a background as public interest lawyers or civil rights lawyers for the most part, just a few. It's one of the things we pushed President Obama on, was to appoint more people who had been federal defenders. That was a big deal. They're all prosecutors. To appoint people who'd been civil rights lawyers, to appoint labor lawyers and so forth. And he's done some of that to his credit. So a lot of what we see is the need to kind of reinvigorate our imagination and to play to that educated function where you're doing things that are unusual, and even if they throw you out, it's a story that you then can elevate, and it suggests what might be possible.
Fabulous.
Thank you.
Mikhail, and I know, I don't know if I want to invite Sudhir or Jane or anybody else who wants to come in, because then we'll have to wrap it up soon, but please.
So thank you again for the fascinating presentations. My name is Michael Svard. I'm a human rights lawyer from Israel. I've been litigating cases on behalf of Palestinian and Israeli communities for the last 15 years, mainly in context of the Israeli occupation over Palestine. Of course, every jurisdiction has its own political and social circumstances, which makes a difference in the way you calculate success in litigation. And I guess the NAACP is to blame for putting a very high standard with Brown on what is considered to be successful litigation. But I would like to flag that when one calculates what is a successful litigation, success is a much more complex thing than just winning or losing. And in my experience and experience of my colleagues back home, there are many, many legal battles that we waged in many cases that were very successful at the end without even one victory, without one injunction in court. So you can get through litigation information, you can get through litigation to coerce the state to get a position, you can get time through for the social movement to organize itself. And I wonder if I think the closest our situation is to South Africa prior to democracy in that sense. And I just wonder if any of you thing that when you calculate your successes, you also take into account other products, byproducts, in which the litigation is a tool that helps the primary force for social change, which is not the court, but the media, the politics, or public perception.
Great. Thank you, Michael. I think Sherilyn has made this point. Do you want to?
I have a follow-up question to
Michael. Okay. Put it on.
Thank
Go
you. Hi, my name is Maisa Zarab. I'm with PILNET. I'm a senior legal officer there for the Middle East and North Africa. We're very proud to have Dimitri as one of our fellows this year. So first of all, thank you all for this very interesting panel. And I would like to just follow up on what you were saying, Michael. It's good to see you again.
Thank
we
you.
Met, I think, maybe a decade ago in Palestine. And our program, the Middle East and North Africa, we're also developing, trying to help our partners in the region develop litigation strategies, and I wanted to ask the panelists to maybe elaborate a little bit more on what you just touched upon, Michael, how to measure success of litigation strategies. And Colin, you were saying earlier that you know, one measure of success might be did you or did you not win the case. Dimitri, you were saying that maybe a measure of success is you didn't even make it to the court and issues were resolved outside of the courtroom. Could the three of you perhaps elaborate a bit more on how to measure that success? Because we're really trying to help our partners in the Middle East and North Africa develop these strategies, help them assess whether or not they've been successful. And we're not quite sure also where to start, because it's quite a new initiative in the Middle East. Maybe we've had a couple of decades there of strategic litigation. We've had some interesting cases in Lebanon, for instance, affirming the right to know, or in Egypt when it comes to labor rights movements and labor affirmation of labor rights. That would be interesting maybe for you, Colin. So yeah, this would be my question. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Colleagues, how do we measure success?
Actually, I started off by taking the meanest standard, which is, you know, if somebody is really out to quiz you on the work that you do, you say, okay, these are my judgments. So that's the sharpest, the meanest, what I call the meanest standard of success. But I agree with you, Michael. In fact, for every success, there are 10 cases where it comes before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court judge, you know, says something which shows how she's thinking. And you have a remarkable success on the spot. 10-1, that's the ratio. Now, can I show anybody, look, I won this case? I can't. But I can certainly explain that when I went to court, this was the situation, and the court remarkably changed. I'll give you the antiretrovirals case. It came before the Supreme Court in India. India took a stand worse than the South African president, right? Who said, no, we won't give the antiretroviral. We took a stand like that for a decade, and the world didn't criticize us. We won't give you antiretrovirals. Came before the Chief Justice. I told the Chief Justice after 2 years of the case pending, I said, you know, sir, the policy of the Indian government is to let people die. Let him file an affidavit and say, this is my policy. I'm not going to give you the antiretroviral. Your policy is to let people die. And after 2 years of hearing me and nagging him, he turned to the Solicitor General and said, Solicitor General, time has come for you to put your policy on paper. Is he right? It seems he's right. Is he right? Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't win that case. 2 months down the line, the Union Health Minister announced the policy of the antiretroviral distribution free. So there are, Michael, you're absolutely right. I'll give you one more example. The disappearances cases in the Northeast. 500 persons disappearing every year. 500 fake encounters, what they call fake, the police say it's a genuine encounter. I was fired at, and we say it's 500. Case comes to the Supreme Court. Case is pending in the Supreme Court. No judgment, nothing. Supreme Court judges just expressing alarm. How can you kill 500 persons a year and not prosecute a single police officer? And last year there was one execution, and that was a genuine encounter with an armed rebel. One. 500-1. Is it a victory? Yes. Is there a judgment? No. So you're absolutely right, Michael.
I think you, in your question, actually gave half of your answer, or in fact, if not the entire answer. You're giving us leading questions. I would say that when looking at the strategic part of litigation, So not just, you know, responding to a client that comes in and because I think, again, those are also sometimes something that I wanted to say earlier. Sometimes something that we ignore is as if the conditions are always ripe for the cases that we do take on and win. And then we can claim that, well, it was always part of the strategy. You know, sometimes you get a case and unfortunately there perhaps isn't the movement that's waiting to support, but you've got clients that are in front of you seeking some kind of recourse and you're the only ones that are able to assist in doing that. So besides those cases, the ones where you are able to have some level of planning and or that you see a string of cases that would form part of a systemic issue. I mean, you know, the ones that you mentioned, for example, it's not just it's an entire political system. In fact, that within which these individual cases are being brought and raised. For me, the issue there's no one answer to it, would be, you know, how does this serve the broader objective? And if so, it might not be able to, the litigation alone might not be able to achieve that by itself, but is there one way in which it actually, you know, contributes towards that? So even if you know, for example, that, you know, you're going to take on a number of cases and possibly lose every single one of them, I still think that there's value in building up that record, for example, that might not lead up to legal victories down the line, but as you know, has been mentioned, it develops, it puts certain information out there. You said it yourself that it requires a certain kind of response, which becomes political statements. It becomes a political record, which then hopefully can be used as part of the same broader political objective that you're working towards, and in that way, the litigation seeks to support it. To give you an example of something that we've taken on, which relates to what you were saying of this important issue of getting government to put its position down in front of a court, can sometimes be very powerful. It was something that was used in the treatment action campaign, the litigation around antiretrovirals. You know, which was a political back and forth. There was a big movement that was being built. There was information about skepticism about the research that had been produced, and so there was this ongoing tug of war in the politics outside. And eventually, the court was able to say, okay, but now the minister can make this statement in the media today and flip flop on that tomorrow, and use this report today and a completely different one tomorrow. But eventually, when you get to court and the court is required to test the kind of reasonableness of that, you get a definitive answer on it. And, you know, the Justice Cameron of the Constitutional Court, he's written a book recently which detailed some of this. And one of the things that he writes about the Treatment Action Campaign, the series of cases, which I found to be quite powerful, was that, you know, after that case, it then settled this debate. It settled some of the political and even some of the debate around the sciences by definitively putting what the court's position is after having considered everything that was presented before them. So I don't think that the answer is simple. Other than to go back to the original question, I think that litigation, if we understand the possible impact of it more broadly than just winning a case, you've mentioned all the other factors where I think it can be absolutely powerful and perhaps have benefits that you don't see in the court process itself.
I think it's also really dangerous for social justice lawyers to be afraid to lose. I mean, I just think that's devastating. You just can't do this well if what you're thinking only is that you're going to win, because you are going to lose a lot of the time. And that's part of, I mean, otherwise then it's not strategic, right? Strategic litigation necessarily means that there's some experimentation involved, and it's not experimentation if there's no chance of failure. So there does have to be a way in which you have calculated some other way that you're advancing the strategy that's not just about your win-loss record. And I'm a big believer, because of what I said earlier, in the creation of the record. The construction of reality around race and oppression is a huge battle. And litigation is one of the places in which, when you get it, you got it, right? It's there, it's got the power of law, a judge has repeated what your client said and therefore made it true. And so that strikes me as very important. And then the last thing I would just say is, there are times when you know, our Supreme Court in this country is extremely conservative. So I regard it as a victory to have helped the court not hear certain civil rights cases. Mm-hmm. I don't want them actually to hear any civil rights cases at this moment. Whatever ones they're hearing, I'm engaging however I can to influence them, but I would really rather them not be hearing them. There's no case that I'm not teeing up right now to bring to this Supreme Court. So there's also that too. There's avoidance is a tactic as well.
So when we thought about putting together this panel, we thought it would be a good idea. But I don't think we anticipated that it would be so rich and so filled with remarkable insights. I want to thank my colleagues, Colin, Sherilyn, and Dimitri, for an extraordinary conversation.